I think we're ready to go with this session. Today's lesson is number 2 in a series of 5 dealing with the topic of leadership. And today's topic specifically is leadership in the home. Kenneth mentioned yesterday that we started from the overall look at leadership, and I think the next 4 days will deal with specific aspects of leadership. God's design for the home is given in several scriptures. We've already mentioned a couple in Genesis chapter 2 and Genesis chapter 3. But in the New Testament, we have very specific guidelines, commandments about what the home is supposed to look like. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 3, "But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman the man, and the head of Christ is God." And Ephesians chapter 5, I'm going to read about 10 verses there. This is chapter 5, verses 23 through 33, and then we'll go back and pick out the ones that are most important for today's discussion. "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband." In many circles, and in many religious circles, the idea that is portrayed here in these 10 verses just sends up an automatic red flag. When we say the idea of the man being over the woman, when we have the idea of the woman being in subjection to her husband, it just automatically charges some people up. I think what some people fail to realize here is that the responsibility is as important for the man in here as it is for the woman, maybe even more so, because the husband is given the responsibility to treat his wife the way Christ treated his church. That is the analogy that is going on there. The family is not an institution that was designed by man. It was created by God. And man has been given the responsibility for stewardship over the family. The husband and wife are responsible for holding it together. Biblical teachings on the male headship are not popular. We live in a society that stresses equal rights and independence rather than submission. The home is valued much less in society today than it was 40 to 50 years ago. And this devaluation of the home is costing society in many ways. I have some statistics from an article from the Maryland Gazette, and I'm sure most of you, or some of you at least, have heard of it. It's August of 2007, and it deals with the father's responsibility. It deals with what happens when the father is not in the home. And some of these are alarming, and we've already talked about statistics. I can validate that this article was in print. I can't validate his or her statistics. But if he is off 50%, they're still alarming. 50% of children living without their fathers have never set foot in their father's home. 63% of young people who commit suicide are from fatherless homes. 85% of children who exhibit behavioral disorders are from fatherless homes. 80% of rapists are from fatherless homes. From 1960 to 1990, the number of children living apart from their biological father went from 17% to 36%. 71% of high school dropouts are from fatherless homes. 75% of adolescent patients in chemical abuse centers are from fatherless homes. 85% of youth that are in prison are in fatherless homes. And 70% of teen pregnancies are the result of fatherless homes. We have came from a nation where we used to talk about our founding fathers to a nation where we can't find our fathers. If we wanted to reduce rapes, we wanted to reduce behavioral disorders, we wanted to reduce suicides, we wanted to reduce high school dropouts, chemical dependency, juvenile delinquency, teen pregnancies, well, the Bible has the answer for that in some regard. It wouldn't eliminate them all, but it would reduce them significantly if fathers would just live up to the responsibility that the Bible has given them. When we don't do things in God's way, we have to suffer the consequences, whether that's a nation, as a family, or as a congregation. 50 to 60 years ago, which some of you can relate to, families were always typically represented in a favorable light. I'll just give you some examples, and they would rate favorably. And if you get a blank look, I'll know that you have no idea what I'm talking about. Ward and June Cleaver, Ozzie and Harriet Nelson, the Waltons, Little House on the Prairie. All those were representations of families in a positive way. What we have seen in the last 50 or 60 years is the family being mocked, the head of the family being mocked or ridiculed, that he's not very intelligent, he's not very smart. We have living arrangements portrayed in entertainment that wouldn't even qualify to be families when we use a scriptural definition. And it's for those reasons that we talk about the subject today and the previous subject, because society just does not look at family and home as it should look at it. But to keep things in a proper perspective and from an avenue of fairness, all of us didn't grow up in Christian homes either, I don't suppose. Many of us came from homes that were perhaps less than ideal for spiritual development. Just on a show of hands, if you want to participate, if not, then just keep your hands down. How many of you were raised in a, we'll call it a Christian home, where both the mother and the father were members of the New Testament church? Yeah. Pretty good number in this group. But there's also a fair number here that were not raised in that environment. And I wasn't raised in that environment. My dad wasn't a believer. He wasn't baptized till, I think he was 78 years old. Kenneth said yesterday that his mom was baptized at 65. My dad was baptized at 78. I had actually served as an officer in the local congregation 8 years before he was ever baptized. I only bring that up to show you that we didn't all come from ideal homes, and to keep the home in its proper perspective. The home is necessary. It's very important. But the home is not the saving institution. The church is the saving institution. We have a young man that I'm familiar with that grew up in the Catholic faith. I wouldn't say that he ever actually bought into it. He wasn't really sold on it. He told me that I could just see some holes in it. He met a girl in college. In the course of their dating, they had Bible studies. He eventually was married to her. And I don't know exactly what went on in that home, but there were some spiritual discussions. And he started taking part, as Kenneth talked about yesterday. He started reading. He gave table talks. He gave some lessons. I was talking to him recently, and he said, "I said, well, how did all that develop?" He said, "My wife
After so long discussing, she says, "You're ready." And I said, "Nah, I'm not ready." He goes, "You're ready." My point being, in that particular home, we had a person that was a strong believer, and we had a person that was a new convert, and the spiritual leadership in that home had to initially come from the female side. Now, that has since transcended. I believe he's in full control of that spiritual home. He was recently appointed an officer in a congregation. Leadership in the home is a stepping stone to leadership in the church. Regardless of the type of home that you grew up in, every home needs spiritual leadership. And sometimes our homes are not ideal. Sometimes due to circumstances like health, spiritual maturity, death, divorce, the spiritual leadership sometimes doesn't come from the father. It didn't come from it in my case. But that didn't doom me. I'm just thankful that my mother did show the spiritual leadership. But in a model home, if there is such a thing exists, we would want the father to exhibit the leadership. Now, you're not unique if you did not come from a home that had a mother and father that were believers. It appears when Peter was writing First Peter chapter 3 and verse 1 and 2, that they had women in the congregation there that he was writing to, that their husbands were not believers. Let me read that to you. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. "Likewise, ye wives, be subject in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by their conversation otherwise, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear." In a group this size, we probably have one-parent households. For whatever reason. Not ideal. If you are the one parent in that household, maybe it's through death, maybe it's through divorce, whatever reason, you need to be the spiritual leader in that household. We may have two-parent households here, with one parent being a believer and the other parent not being a believer. The believing parent has to take the leadership role in the spiritual development until that changes. We have parents here that have little children. We probably have someone in an audience this size that's expecting. I think. There was a lot of padding going on yesterday, and I thought I assumed that right. People in that situation, their households are changing. They have young ones or young ones on the way, and there's going to have to be more leadership because there's going to be more people in that family. We probably have households here where we have grown children caring for their parents and their children at the same time. We have three generations under one roof. You may have a home where you're providing care or support for someone that's not even physically related to you, but it's your home. And again, regardless of the makeup of the home that you find yourself in, there must be leadership in that home from a temporal angle and a spiritual angle. Let's talk about some principles and responsibilities of leadership. When you think of good leaders, maybe we could think of it from a secular angle just for a minute. One of the things that makes for good leaders is who they surround themselves with. One of the first things a president of the United States will do, he will select a cabinet. People that he can trust, people that are going to helping get his policies across. So you, and from this point on, we're primarily talking about the males. You, as a male, who is your advisor? Well, your advisor, using that word, comes from Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18. The Lord said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make a help meet for him." After reading that verse and hearing that verse 100 times, I thought maybe I'll look up and see what that means. It didn't really mean anything different than I had always thought, but I did get a little bit more information on it. John mentioned it this morning. The idea of helpmeet here means helper, suitable. It means complementary. When we look at the word, the root word, what it means equal but opposite. Now, what does that mean? Equal but opposite. Well, it's fairly simple. You have two hands. They are equal, but they're opposite. How would it have been, and when the Lord created us, if He had gave us two right hands? Well, they just wouldn't have been functional. And that seems to be the way with a husband and wife. They're equal, but they're opposites, just like your hands are opposites. Mm-hmm. Woman was given to man for the purpose of being her husband's helper. Leading a family is a dual responsibility between the husband and wife, with the ultimate responsibility resting on the husband. Man, your wife is your most loyal and trusted advisor. You should realize that. You should not be making decisions without consulting her, talking to her, and saying, here's what I'm thinking about doing. What do you think? You two made covenants with each other when you were first married to help each other, and a whole long list of things that you were going to do, and those covenants didn't end as long as both of you were still alive. You're not in competition with each other. You both want the same result. You need to work together. We shouldn't ridicule each other. We shouldn't scorn each other. We shouldn't shame each other, publicly or privately. Sometimes when I hear either a man or a woman complain about their mate, I just stop and think, now wait a minute. You picked her. Or if he asked you, you said yes. What does that say about you if you're complaining about the one you picked? It says your decision wasn't very good. So I think we need to be very careful how we treat our wives. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3 is not written for the specific purpose of marriage, but it's like so many other scriptures, it's surely applicable. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Men, your wife is not a slave to you that you boss around and treat her like a slave. It's not the way that the Bible says. You treat one another with proper respect. She is not the old lady. I just cringe when I hear a male refer to their wife as the old lady. That is not respectful regardless of her age. I don't like when a woman refers to her husband as an old man. That's not respectful. She is your trusted advisor. She is the one that is going to give you the best advice. She's going to be the one that tells you the truth. And I'm probably getting into Gerald's area tomorrow, but if I am, Gerald, you got 24 hours to come up with something new, I suppose. Responsibilities of the leader of a family. I have two or three areas that we want to talk about. Number one, the male is the provider for the family. I believe that includes the area of financial, and I also, of course, believe it corresponds to the idea of spiritual. 1 Timothy 5 and 8 would cover the financial end of it. Anyone who does not provide for their relatives, and especially for their own household, has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's pretty strong words. Men have the responsibility to provide for their families. I'm not against women working outside the home. I'm not against that at all. But the woman has responsibilities. If she chooses to do that, she still must be the keeper of the home, as directed by Titus. I'm not against the woman making more money than the man. It happens sometimes. But this does not relieve the man of the responsibility from the financial end to be the provider for the family. I do have somewhat of a reaction when a person decides that they're going to be a stay-at-home dad. I just think that you're violating what it said when you're the provider for the family. The kids need care. I'm not doubting that. But I'm thinking that you're missing the point of being the provider for the family. Number two, besides being the provider, we need to be the protector for the family. And the protection of our family is it's ever-changing from what it was years ago. It, of course, would include physically protecting them, but I think that's probably not as a big issue. But spiritually, we need to protect them. The subject that we talked about in John's class, males, you're responsible for dealing with that issue in your family. Protect them spiritually so that they know what the truth is. Men, we need to protect our wives mentally, emotionally. And that seems to be the hardest thing for many men because we're not very emotional. Colossians chapter 3 and 19, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Don't treat them badly. Watch your tone. Watch what you say. Choose your words carefully. That goes with everybody, so surely it fits with your wife as well. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Do you want your prayer life to be more efficient, more successful? Part of it depends upon how you're going to treat your wife. You need to be the protector of your family with regards to where your kids are going and who they're going with. We all remember our childhood, and we all were just trying to be a little bit sneaky and getting away from our parents. But our parents, you just need to know. I heard a story recently. It didn't involve our family personally, but as you get older and your kids leave home, you learn a lot more about them than you thought you knew. And this particular story dealt with a family that were allowing their children to go to some friend's house, spend the night. And they found out years later that what was going on in that house would not have been tolerated in their own house. It had to do with the type of movies that were being shown and what they were. The parents were home at the visiting house, but they were allowing things that the parents that were sending the kids, they would have just never allowed that in that home. Sometimes people put up a good front, and we judge them to be good moral people, but we need to be very careful where we're letting our children go and what they're being subject to, because we don't live in a very good society. As the father, you are responsible for your family as the spiritual instructor, the nurturer. You're responsible to lead them in worship. And what that entails in my mind is you decide where your family's going to worship. You decide how often they're going to worship. You decide where you're going to live. So that you cannot use your distance from the assembly house as an excuse for your lack of worship. I'm going to read in Deuteronomy chapter 6, and this may have, I'm not sure if this was read earlier in the week or not. It's Deuteronomy chapter 6, and it's 9 verses long. And what I'm looking for here is not that we do this verbatim, but we do it based on the principle that is shown here. Now these are the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God commanded to teach you, that you might do them in the land whither you go to possess it. That thou mightest fear the Lord thy God, to keep all his statutes, his commandments, which I command thee, thou and thy son, and thy son's sons, all the days of thy life, and that the days may be prolonged. Hear therefore, Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, and that they may increase mightily, as the Lord God of thy fathers has promised thee, in the land that floweth with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart.
Thou shalt teach them diligent unto the children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine head, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and on thy gates. So how would we apply that principle in our homes today? As leaders of our children, how would we do that? Well, I found that that our children were, we could really capture their attention when we were in the car. It was a contained audience. And it seemed like we spent a lot of time in cars. So I think a proper application would be when you have their attention, you have them all in one location, you can rehearse things. You're on your way home from services, you can go over the particular sermon, the Bible study. If they're children of a small age, you can ask them, what did you do in class today? And I think many of you do that. Now just to take that one step further, let's not be critical of our brethren with our children. Even among ourselves, let's not be critical with our brethren. But use what just kind of comes naturally. They've been in the church service. Find out what they heard. Sometimes they hear different things than maybe what you heard. And there you can head off some problems. In the car, at the table. I don't know how many people make it a regular habit in your home to have everybody eat at a certain time. And I know that's kind of a hard thing to do, and it's probably an outdated thing to do, but it was one of the things we tried to do, and we met some opposition with that. I've got to be here, I've got to go there. But it seemed to be a good thing that worked for us was that if your family situation exists, there is a time that you can all be there to just find out what's going on in each person's life. The fourth thing that we need to be as leaders in our family is to encourage and exhort. Now, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 10, 11, and 12, which I'm going to read, I don't think you would recognize that verse as being a verse about family, because that is not the primary focus. But when I read it to you, and in context with what I've already said, I think you're going to understand why we're supposed to be encouragers and exhorters. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave toward you believers, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. The reference there is to Paul and his relationship with the church at Thessalonica. I'm doing this just like you would do with your children. It's the assumption there that that's how you're going to treat your children. You're going to encourage them. Well, what does it mean to encourage? How do we exhort our children? Well, I think the number one thing with our children is to be positive with them. Reinforce positive behavior. Tell them when they do something correctly, I appreciate that. Don't take things for granted. Let them know verbally. Let them know physically, if it's a hug, that you really appreciate that. And I also believe in punishment. I mean, the Bible bears that out. We have a little antidote about that later, depending upon the time. But husbands should influence their wives and their families in accordance with biblical teaching. When something comes up, they do this, and you can just tell them, well, that's the way the Bible wants it done. Husbands should demonstrate in their actions and in their words attributes that bring glory to God and value to the spouse and the family. Let's think about leadership. When we think of leaders in general, we probably put them in three or four categories. Military leaders, political or government leaders, maybe labor leaders or union leaders or corporate leaders, CEOs, maybe even an athletic team that has coaches and general managers. It was my intent when I started this lesson to take some examples from some of those leaders.
I think Time Magazine had an article here years ago about the 100 most influential leaders in the world. But after starting on that, I did the same thing that Rick did with his introduction to the biology class years ago at KU. Hurried it up and threw it away. All those different types of leaders, those 100 great leaders, then they did some great things for society, is different than biblical leadership. Biblical leadership in the home is not about power. It's not about money. It's not about fame or fortune. But it's something more valuable than that. The goal of biblical leadership is the salvation of the people in that house. So I did want to give you some qualities that I thought are important for leaders. And with the exception of one, these would be biblical qualities. The first one is a biblical quality. It's just it's a secular quote. Secular quote from Robert E. Lee dealing with the choice of army leaders in the Civil War. And his quote was on leadership, "I cannot trust a man to control others if he cannot control himself." So number one, as a leader of your family, you have to be in control of yourself. Number two is, and this was mentioned this morning, in relationship to Jesus coming down from heaven, is the idea of humility. The idea of humbleness. Numbers chapter 12 and verse 3 says that Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. In certain translations it uses the word meek, I think, there. But what it means is strength under control. This is a very important point for fathers, is that leadership in your family is not about power, it's about responsibility. Moses had tremendous amount of power through the aid of God, but he kept that under control. You as a father, you have power. You're bigger, you're larger. But you don't use that power in a sinful way. You have to keep that under control, as Moses did. In Daniel chapter 1, verse 8, I think John may have mentioned this. If he did mention this verse, he mentioned the thought. Talking about Daniel in captivity, and it talked about him choosing to abstain from the food that was offered to him, it says in verse 8, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself." As a leader of your family, you need the conviction and the consistency of Daniel. I don't know of anything that will influence a child more than to see their father or mother say one thing and then do something completely opposite. If you are a different person in your home than you are in the assembly, I guarantee you your children will see through that very quickly. We must be consistent. We must have a conviction in our own lives that the way we're going about it is the right way. As a parent, as a leader in your house, you must have the vision of Joseph. Genesis chapter 50. Joseph, after identifying himself to his brothers who had sold him into slavery years before, paraphrasing what he said is, "God meant it for good." Joseph was able to see the big picture. Sometimes his parents were just so involved so much in the drama of the day that we don't see the big picture. Sometimes we just need to step back and try to see the big picture as Joseph did. In Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15, we need to have the assertiveness of Joshua. I'm going to read that one. Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15.
And if it seem evil unto you, serve the Lord. Choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. We must have that assertiveness. We can't come across as wishy-washy as spiritual leaders. We must be very assured of what we're teaching them. And then one last thing, that a quality that a leader should have, is 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, and perhaps more relevance today than in the day that it was written for today's families. And the message of 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2 is that we would lead simple lives. The actual application there as it was written was, I'll just read it to you. I exhort therefore that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority. And here is the reason you make those requests, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. It seems that many of us could improve our lives if we would just simplify them. If we would just cut out some of the stuff, whatever that stuff is. All right. In the last few minutes, let me tell you a couple of things that a leader is not. I've told you some of the qualities that would make a good leader. These are the qualities that you should not. Number one, a leader is not a driver. Those are two different things. If God wanted you to be a driver, He would have called us cattle and not sheep. You drive cattle, you lead sheep. It just seems very, very basic. By definition, if you are the leader of your family, you need to be in the middle of that family, or not the middle, you need to be at the head of that family. The old war stories where the general or the Indian, he's up on the brink of the valley watching this war take place. Well, that's a leader in a sense, but that doesn't work for the family. You can't be detached from your family. You need to be there. You're not in the rear. You're not up at a higher vantage point. You need to be involved with your family if you're going to be the leader. You need to be connected. You need to be aware. So number one, we shouldn't be drivers. We should be leaders. Number two, you are not perfect. If you think just because you're a leader you're going to get everything right, well then you need to just rethink your thinking. You need to take a note from King David's life. When he realized he had messed up, he said, "I have sinned." When you mess up with your family, you need to tell them, "I messed up." Don't be so proud, so arrogant of your position that you can't reverse a bad decision. If you made a bad decision, tell them, "I made a bad decision. Just messed up." And they will have, I think, respect for you, and they'll feel better about it. This is a story. This will be the antidote. It's a true story. A man, Northern Missouri, years ago, punished his son, gave him a spanking. I don't even know if you can say that anymore. There's probably somebody going to sue us for that. But he gave him a spanking, and all the time the son was telling his dad, "I didn't do it. I didn't do it." Of course, every kid that's been reprimanded says that, so the dad didn't believe him. But in this particular case, the kid didn't do it. And that fact came to light sometime later. And the dad said to the kid, "Well, that spanking was for all the times you did something wrong and I didn't know about it." I don't know if that's exactly the attitude that we would want to display. You can't take back corporal punishment. You've already did it. But you can surely apologize. Kenneth had a verse yesterday that we'll close with. Genesis chapter 18, verse 19, talking about Abraham. "For I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken to him about." A father is to lead his family in the way that Christ has led the church, lovingly and tenderly but firmly, always seeking the greatest good not for himself but for the family. If you want to lead your family in the way that the Scriptures suggest, you'll study how Christ led the church, and you'll do the same for your family. And then the other point being is how you lead your family will have an effect on future generations, because you're raising a family. If they have a favorable experience, they can just grow upon what you have taught them. And I'm ahead of schedule, and you've got a long break. Thanks for your attention.